Hello, folks. Welcome back to the High Performance Human Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Ward, founder of the triathloncoach.com, High Performance Human, and the SWAT Inner Circle. And I am on a mission to help you upgrade your human performance. I truly believe that we all have the potential to perform better as humans through improved sleep, nutrition, fitness, mobility, and stress management. And in doing so, live longer, live healthier, and of course, improve your athletic performance. If you're interested in joining me on this journey, check out my SWAT Inner Circle, where you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. All you need to do is email Beth at thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes. Now to this week's guest, I'm going to be chatting with strength and mobility expert, Dr. Kelly Starrett. Dr. Starrett's a physiotherapist, founder of Mobility Wad, and the author of four books, How to Be a Supple Leopard, Ready to Run, Desk Bound, and Waterman. And to be quite honest, I love this conversation. We could have chatted all day, and I hope to get Kelly back on for another podcast. But in this edition, we're going to be talking about Kelly's definition of mobility, why you should continue to do what works for you and reject what doesn't, regardless of the research. Should we refer to mobility as position transfer exercise? How to create a durable body so you can play as much as you want and in doing the best with your body in the context of your life. How much mobility we should do each day and why it's important for us all to engage in regular movement practice like yoga or Pilates. Kelly talks about how he uses social media as a teaching platform, not as a way of finding out what his friends are doing. We talk about why good mobility allows you to control, not compensate. We get into the weeds a little bit on foam rolling and whether you should or you shouldn't. And we talk about Kelly's pursuit of adventure fitness rather than training. So let's crack on with today's guest. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kelly Starrett, all the way from San Francisco.
Nice to see you, my friend.
Very nice. Pleasure to have you on the show, Kelly. Ever since I got this book here. There it is.
Boy. Oh, boy. Well, don't worry. We have another fatter one coming out. Don't worry.
Kelly. There's, as part of my triathlon coaching, there's some swim books I have by a swim coach called Ernest Maglishko. I think he wrote a book called Swim Faster. Then he wrote Swim Even Faster, then Swimming Fastest. And each one is thicker than the one before. And if you ever need to adjust the height of your laptop so that the camera's right, these books are perfect.
It is. It's true. And, you know, it's not our fault. You know, what we say is, like, here's our best understanding in the moment, and let's get started. And then all of those masters that I follow, all of the brilliant, I mean, there's so many brilliant thinkers doing a good job of synthesis and integration right now, that the next step is, you know, again, looking at your own model, seeing what's not as effective. And then we've all been practicing, so it's not my fault that I, you know, it's getting thicker, but be prepared for another 100 pages. Ultimately, we're going to have it with a handle so you can strength train with it. That's really the goal.
Excellent. Using your environment to get fit. Well, listen, let's before we get into the weeds of your books and what you currently do, I'd like to go back a little bit. Let's find out how you got to this point. I did a little bit of reading up. So you were a kayaker.
Don't hold it against me. I was that kid with the canoe on the roof. You know, I started paddling at a very early age. It just fell into a community. It was the community did it. And then it really carried me and was the thing that I was the most interested in my whole life. And I still am a avid paddler, still love to paddle, still run rivers with my family. I actually met my wife at the World Championships even in Chile a million years ago. And I have to tell you that, you know, it really framed a lot of my current experience because, you know, it was great to be a professional athlete, great to paddle on the national team, great to compete in these World Championships. But I also went through the model that so many of us experience, which is, do more volume, more sessions. And then one day my hand went numb and I had this brachial plexus spinal injury, and it was completely from poor breathing mechanics. I'm sure wretched 22 year old nutrition, you know, horrible asymmetries, and then just freakish amount of volume with zero idea about positional quality, positional integrity. We couldn't even tell. I mean, it was just, as long as the coach looked at the stopwatch and you went faster, that was how we did it. And when I asked everyone about it, they said, well, you know, yeah, of course, everyone breaks. This is what happens. And then what we'll do is we'll just wait a little bit longer. Then hopefully you can make it further next time. And I was like, you knew this would happen to me? You know, like, there's got to be a different way. And really, that's the genesis of so much of my thinking is not only asking ourselves, can we be more durable and more effective? Because it takes a lot to train at a high level of sport. But secondarily, you know, how do we run a diagnostic program on athletes that are concurrent? So it's a parallel diagnostic program. How do we understand what's happening in real time? And it can't be necessarily, you know, like you see your dentist every 6 months for a checkup. You can't see your physio every 6 months for a checkup because the body changes and your range of motion is rented and your movement quality all the time. So that's really what we're going to have to do a better job of is helping athletes and coaches speak in language where we can identify a movement inefficiency, a movement problem, remedy it, and still keep the athlete training, not pull the athlete out and do low-level rehab.
It's interesting what you say there, because I probably was that person. And, you know, just like, well, this is what happens when you're training for an Ironman, you're bound to get injured.
Yes, really.
So it's sort of like a friend coming back when you get injured. It's like, oh, I feel comfortable with this. Off we go, ring the physio. And of course, when you do get injured, you especially, you know, I think the statistics show that 70 to 80% of injuries in triathlon, particularly, are running related and below the knee. So when you've got an injured part of your lower limb, you can't run at all. So it's painful, it's frustrating, and it's expensive to go and get that treatment. As I've got older, I've realized that the best way to minimize the expense is actually to pay to see the white witch, as I call her, Louisa, to see her once a month proactively. And you know what, when I go there, she says, oh, your hip's tight there, or you're not walking too well, Simon, you're a little kinked here. She does a little bit of manipulation and mobilization. I spend an hour there, and then I'm good to go for the next 4 weeks. And I've been trying to persuade people that this is a better option to pay forward. And it's taking forever to get through. People would just rather carry on training and wait until they break because they think that's what's supposed to happen.
You're really spot on there. And, you know, one of the things that we have done a poor job of sort of identifying, what is injury? Because people use, they bandy about this word. And so I'm really trying to help us define injury. What does injury mean? Well, it means you can't do your job, can't occupy a role in society, can't recreate. That's part of it. That's an injury, right? And, or you've got some clear pathology, something going on, or a clear mechanism of injury. You crashed on your bike, you broke your collarbone. Like, it's sticking out of your skin. Like, those things happen. That's right.
You can see it through that jacket.
That's right. That's why I use that example for all my cyclist friends, right?
Yeah.
So everything else, though, isn't an injury. And if I ask you how many of your athletes are, I get into a group of athletes, room of athletes, and say, how many of you are pain-free? It turns out very few are pain-free. Mm-hmm. And what we have not done is realize that pain is look, first and foremost, if you are an athlete, and especially if you're a suffer sport athlete, right? Sort of my wife and I are mountain bikers now. That's what we do predominantly, and we're still paddlers. But if I dropped into your brain in the middle of a race, I would die. I would just perish of the pain. I would just like curl up into a little fetal position. It's so painful. The suffering is so immense. And so we can't use this idea of waiting around for the car engine to blow up or for myself not to be able to take a step on my foot. And that's where most of us are initiating a conversation about our mechanics, a conversation about our tissue quality, a conversation about our environment or our lifestyle, when we are confronted with the fact that we can't do something we want. And then we're like, okay, now I've got religion. What was that you were saying about all that? And then we just shotgun it, right? We'll just shoot it down. But really what we've got to do is do a much better job of appreciating that pain is such a wonderful diagnostic tool. That if something is achy, and don't get me wrong, if you go for a long run, and I guarantee you over the course of 5 hours of running, your brain is going to be like, your hips got cancer, your left knee has rabies, like you've been attacked by a wolverine on your calf, like pay attention. And they change because your brain is trying to conserve itself. But you know the difference of, hey, my knee hurts after this big run. And what we want to people to do is just appreciate that that's just information. You're not injured. Tissue isn't broken, right? You don't even have tissue damage, but that is the same level of information as, wow, my wattage sucked today. It was off on my intervals today. Where we start to make sort of connections between our environment and our ability to cope in that environment, the safety of our tribe, our health, sleep, all of those things that matter. Plus, we're going to add positional quality. And what we've done for the last 2 decades especially is ripped out position as part of this conversation of mechanics, right?
Let me go back to your kayaking then, Kelly. You said you were doing a lot of volume there. What part did lifting play in that way? I mean, were you lifting already before you got into kayaking, or was it something you just did as a teenage boy looking at those muscle magazines and thinking about body image, or was it encouraged upon you by your coach saying, you know, you need to build up those shoulders and arms so you can paddle a bit?
I knew that we needed to lift. Like, so my friends and I lifted, but let me put in quotation marks, lifting, right? A lot of selectorized machines, a lot of like, you know, we were trying to do the right thing. We were, you know, and really this is, I think, opens up such a wonderful level of discussion because, you know, what we said to, let me start by saying that I believe wholeheartedly that athletes do what works and they reject what doesn't work. So I think that many people say things like, there's no science behind that. And I'm like, well, you know, this has been around a long time, and that in and of itself isn't enough for us to say that this is a sufficient or the best practice or the best way. But what you really are saying to people when you tell them or poo on their system is you're saying you're too dumb to know what works and doesn't work for your body. And that is bananas. So if one of my friends, here's an example, was the strength coach for the Golden State Warriors, pretty good basketball team. You may have heard of them. They've won a few games. And one of the star players there said to him, when I bench press, I play great. And he's like, great, let's bench. So they bench before every game. And he was like, you're the best strength coach in the world. Literally, I don't know what it was about the benching, the psychology of it. And it doesn't mean he had to do, you know, sets to failure. But benching made him believe and made him feel connected. And guess what? As a coach, I listen to that. And that, so you do a little benching, you play world-class basketball, you win a championship, it doesn't lose your positions, you don't become weaker. And what we want to make sure that we're understanding is that when we ask people, you know, how are you understanding your body? How are you doing what's working? Then we can, you know, trust our athletes to start to pay it forward, to start to work. So when we, you know, when we're doing strength training, what we saw was that the athletes were sitting down and going to doing bodybuilding things. And they were like, I don't think this is a good use of my time. I feel tired. It didn't make me run faster, right? I wasn't more explosive. It didn't take away my pain. It's gone. And so a lot of what we just said was get stronger. Well, how, I don't know who's strong. Well, all these football players. Well, I'm not sure the football players the way I want to, you know, like American football players. Like, does my swimmer need to train like a rugby player? No. Are there foundational patterns and shapes between the two? Of course. But what we did was we just said, strength solves all problems. So just get stronger globally. Well, I don't even know what that means. And what we saw was low level, low skill, once again, high physiology activities on top of athletes who did not need that. They needed more skill, coordination, restoration, position, mechanics. And of course, as a side effect, you'll get stronger of that. But what we did was we once again said to athletes, you know, you don't know what's good for you. You don't know what makes you faster. You don't have feelings. You know, and that's really just disingenuous. So we lifted, but we weren't using that strength training as a correlate diagnostic program because that's makes it so, it's really difficult to self-assess what your swim stroke looks like. How do I know? Because every swimmer I know has a swim coach on the deck, right? But it's really easy for me to see if you have a complete overhead position or complete hang shape or enough shoulder extension when we start doing these other movements. And then all of a sudden I can see what's happening, make the invisible visible.
See, what I'm interested in is this journey you had from being a kayaker, and you know, I understand that eventually that injury put paid to your kayaking career.
That's right.
At what point did you did you switch your lifting over to something that was going to be a positive contribution to your kayaking? And also, when did you realize that mobility had a part to play in that? And because obviously there's a time when in switching over from that you end up qualifying professionally as a doctor, and you do all that and you start your CrossFit gym, and that's obviously a sort of like a generalized way of strength training rather than a specialized way of strength training. So there must have been a mindset change there as well at some point.
Yeah, good on you for recognizing that. You know, one of the things I want everyone to appreciate is everyone comes out of a system. Everyone comes out of a tradition, right? Mm-hmm. And if you were, you know, you're lucky to have a world Olympic class track coach, probably track has been doing it better than most people the longest, I think, in terms of looking at the whole body. And probably because track is fundamentally running, jumping, and throwing. I mean, the foundations of being good human function, right? And so they really have got really good at making people fast and having trained them to run long and be strong enough to do those things. But if you didn't come out of an Olympic Eastern sport track tradition or Olympic lifting tradition, chances are you just did you know, like whatever crappy Atlas exercise your grandpa did and, you know, the guys at the gym did or the ladies did to tone their butts. And I put that in just quotation marks for everyone. And so, you know, one of the things that happened is that I loved to train. I loved to train. This is like, you know, I have this high genetic drive to move. And I knew, so my wife and I, you know, were going to a big global gym. And, you know, I was always seeking. And I sort of knew intuitively, I was like, there's something to gymnastics. I wish I'd spoken more of gymnastics. And we'll just qualify gymnastics as body weight control in space, right? Basic somersaulting, basic body weight control, spines out of just a rigid straight up and down position. And then I knew that I needed to learn how to Olympic lift. So all of the while that I am still just a recreational athlete now, I'm qualifying for the PT school. I had to go back to school and get a bunch of, my chemistry was too old. I needed the second semester of physics, things like that. So I'm going through that process and I start working with some of these coaches. And then, I'm sort of understanding what's going on. And what I'll say is, you know, during my first year of physio school, I discovered this thing called CrossFit. And CrossFit is very loaded right now, or is evolving. But in its early days, no one was very strong, no one was very fit, and no one was very skilled. That's really the case when we first started this thing. And, you know, we couldn't buy kettlebells in the city of San Francisco. We had to drive 2 hours to buy kettlebells. So the world really has changed a lot. Like, you can buy a kettlebell at a grocery store now. I mean, really, this is the truth. And, you know, I bought my first pair of Olympic lifting shoes out of the trunk or the boot of someone's car. You know what I mean? Like, that's how it was, right? Like, you just knew someone who had some shoes that they ordered from China. And like, you're just like, okay, I guess this is how it's done. This is really weird. And we weren't very sophisticated. And that's definitely because the internet wasn't really what the internet was. So I'm in physio school. I discovered this thing. And I really realized that I am not skilled. I'm not strong. And I'm not coordinated. I thought I really was. I'm a national champion. I'm a really good athlete. I thought I had a big engine. It turns out I just had these glaring holes. And so second semester of PT school, I realized, hey, I want to open a gym. So my second year of physio school, I opened the gym. And what ends up happening now is I start having larger groups of people, you know, consider much kind of bigger groups where that I'm asking them to do these fundamental things. Does your hip flex? Yes or no? Can you put your hip into extension? Can you put your arms over your head? Right? Do you have these basic things? And then what I realized ultimately, what I was doing was saying, okay, here are these things, these ranges, these physiologic base, these bookends that everyone should be able to do. And then all I'm doing is challenging it with a little load. I'm challenging it with a little speed. I'm challenging it with a little cardiorespiratory demand or metabolic demand. You have to do it in an open torque environment, which means you need to do it with a dumbbell and a kettlebell. And you also need to be able to grab a barbell, right? I need to see that if you change skills quickly, that you can pick up a new skill. I need to see that you can do that when we're competing against someone else. And something I was like, oh, this isn't about exercise at all. This is about base position. And meanwhile, remember, I'm in this classic formal physio training. And I'm really struggling to reconcile what I'm learning at physio school with how athletes actually train. And how national training teams work and how the Olympic Training Center works. And it turns out they're completely separate languages. It's like, no, physio is like Esperanto. And the way the rest of the world works is like we speak English or classic Spanish, right? And so I was like, why are we speaking these two different languages? And what I suddenly realized was that I was having these adults come in and they didn't have the basics in anything. They weren't very skilled. They couldn't feel. What that moment was when I was like, okay, well, more exercise isn't solving this problem. But what I realized is that as I began to use my advanced manual mobilization techniques to restore people's position, I was able, and I wasn't about pain. Like, I had just taken pain out. Like, I'm just like, hey, I see that you can't put your arms over your head. Let me mobilize your joint capsule. Let me get into your T-spine. And I was doing that manually. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, I was having athletes PR win national championships. And they weren't coming to me because they were in pain. They were coming to me because they couldn't get into a position. And that's where we just started to describe this language of mobilization, which is really when I describe mobility, and I apologize for that word because I'm the person who's at the root of that word now. No one used the word mobility, and I use that word specifically not to be stretching, not to be, you know, myofascial release. I really chose a separate word and defined it as, do you have the range of motion that you're supposed to have as a human being? Every doctor, every physio, every chiro agrees on we should have. that every coach knows you should have, because it's the root shapes of every good technique in any sport that we teach. And then can you control that, right? And that coordination and skill practice. And so our mobilizations ended up being what we call position transfer exercises, so that you could go back and do the thing you're doing, right? And that's really where I started to understand the power of helping people understand why they couldn't be in a shape, or if they were making a technique movement error.
I like that phrase, position transfer of exercise, because I'm going to come back to that in a moment when we talk about your book, Supple Leopard, and the whole concept that leopards never actually stretch. And so, so if you started your CrossFit place in 2005, you must have been one of the first in the world then, were you?
We were 21st in the world. Yeah. Yeah. And remember, it was an experiment. It was an emergent phenomenon. And there was no Olympic lifting on the internet. There was no, Pavel had put out some really good books about some basic kettlebell stuff and stuff.
I've got Pavel's name written down here to talk about a bit later, actually.
And that's fantastic. My hypothesis now, I've become very reasonable as I've gotten older. I'm 47. I'm really, everything about me is being durable enough to go play as much as I want to play. That is the only goal I have. But I have this hypothesis that if we just gave every cyclist, every swimmer, every runner, a kettlebell, that's probably enough. I can program enough good work with a kettlebell. If I taught every child in America how to swing and press a kettlebell or walk around with it or squat with it, that'd be enough. And then we can scale it from there.
Well, just down to my right here, I've got 5 different kettlebell weights. I do my little thing. We'll talk about some of Pavel's principles in a moment. So you were... I guess from all of that learning, after you started your CrossFit place, you started the mobility WOD with your wife, which going strong. Yeah.
Yeah. What was interesting is, so like so many coaches, I was just a local coach. I didn't have any intentions of trying to move the planet with a long lever, be a knucklehead. I really was seeing that there was a missing common language of movement, and people were really complex, sophisticated people were coming to see me for very simple problems that frankly I thought were a waste of my time. Wait a minute, you flew over here to tell me that your quads are stiff. Why didn't you know that? That's not something, and I don't mean tight, you're weak and you're trying to hold on. I mean, you're stiff, a creaky door hinge is stiff. Why didn't you do something about that? What I would actually come home to my wife and I'd be like, okay, I think there are 7 problems, really. Everything is derivative of these 7 problems. And so what I set out to do is make a video a day for a year, just so I could also use it as a reference, as a coach. Hey, I need you to go watch video 232 and 275, right? So it was homework for me. And it was creating a library. And I told a friend about it. Hey, I'm doing this mobility project. And then it just took wildfire. I mean, just wildfire. And then that's literally how it started. And what I thought was I'd get to the end of 365 and not have anything else to say. And boy, was I wrong. I had a lot more to say, because as I had more data sets, as I got to work with more interesting populations and more unique kind of cultures of movement, I understood more, could refine more, could talk more, expand more. So that's really what it started out as, was me trying to improve my own community. And I think now when young coaches are coming out, they're like, hey, I'm going to have an Instagram channel and YouTube and boom, be huge. I'm like, knock that off. You need to serve your athletes obsessively, right? And that will be enough.
That's what I was going to say, is you started out with this idea of serving your athletes, and what it's done is it's put you out there as the trusted authority, but you didn't set out with the ambition of being a trusted authority. You set out with the ambition of just educating people a little bit more wider than your local circle. And
yeah, the iPhone did not have a video camera. I think you have to understand that. There was no Instagram. Twitter was barely a thing. And so we really, YouTube was nascent and emergent. And what we started out, no one knew what the power of this thing was. And, now, I mean, honestly, before the shutdown, I literally was like that old crusty guy, all these young whippersnappers. There's just so much bullshit, so much crap out there, because everyone is an expert, because that's how, we can make it shiny. And it is confusing a little bit for people, So, we were just seeing sort of the expression of all that, coming to fruition, which is, a Kraken we all unleashed. But the goal now is to be a, you know, be a savage generalist and serve your community better. And that will be enough. I promise you, people will find you if you do that better than everyone else does that.
And I think it's all about the end goal that you start out with. If you're starting out, you know, I met a guy the other day, he says, I want to start a podcast like yours, Simon. And, you know, I reckon I can make this a channel, a money-making channel. I'm like, you know what? I started my podcast because it's a self-serving project to allow me an excuse to talk to really smart people and learn from them. And I just figured that other people might listen to, might like listening to those conversations as well, right? I didn't start out with the idea of having a Joe Rogan-style podcast where Spotify are going to come along and give me a big check to take it. That's, you know, I don't make anything from these podcasts. I don't have any sponsors or any adverts. I pay for it all myself.
I
put it out there because it's actually speaking with people like you and you know, your peer group and your colleagues is just, it's an amazing privilege for me. But, and I just think, well, more people need to hear about these conversations.
And that's, you know,
that's started out.
One of my best friends is a Highland Games champion, world champion. And he has this thing. He's like, step one, like have an idea. Step three, profit, you know? And you're sort of like, well, I don't know. How long have you been coaching? Like, you know, are you capable? Can you talk to people? And it really is. I think that's, it's okay that people are misinformed about that. I mean, you know, the ego it took for my young self to be like, hey, I think we can do this better. Like, hey, you know, part of what we really put our flag in was this idea of test, retest, and share, that we were part of a global, transparent group of coaches that all helped each other solve each other's problems. And when I saw people like Joe DeFranco and even early CrossFit and all the people out there who were transparent in their coaching, you can still pay for that private coaching, but transparent in their methodologies and consistent, you know, what we saw was, well, I was able to pick up the phone and call some of my coach heroes, and they answered the phone, and I was able to talk to them. Like, you can't do that now. It's madness, right? But that was then. But what I picked up from them was they were like, sure, you can come. You know, I'll be there. I'll be at the gym at 4:30 in the morning. See you there. And I was like, all right. And I'd show up at 4:30 in the morning, ready to like shut the fuck up and listen and watch and just be a participant, do what it asked. And, you know, this idea of test and retest. How do I know something? Well, I'm working on it. It's a living laboratory. It's a scientific process. Sir Francis Bacon has this idea of the scientific process, which is induction through large data sets, understanding patterns and relationships. That's science, not running an experiment, trying to understand first principles, trying to understand best practice within the individuals, all of that. And then when you know something, we test and retest and we share it and we confirm it. Does this work for you? How's this working? Because, you know, I don't think people realize how much coaching goes on between coaches. There's no master coach, super coach anymore. All those coaches have a peer group. They have women and men who they ask ideas and get confirmation bias. And that's how we move everything forward.
I get accused quite often of giving away too much for free. And, my answer to that is that this knowledge that I've acquired has been shared with me by other gracious coaches who are at the top of their profession and who are maybe, you know, in their 60s or 70s now. So they're sort of hanging up their stopwatch. And I'm the custodian. And somebody has got to come along after me and you. And so it's our responsibility to then be able to pass that information on to them, and then they can adapt it. And, you know, it's almost like you've got the baton now. So you do with it the right thing and then make sure you pass it on to somebody else. Don't hoard it and try and make a profit out of it, you know, because actually this information isn't a secret. It's freely available out there. All that we've done is sifted out the bullshit, taken the stuff that's worked over the generations, used it in our own principles and philosophies. And now here you go. It's your turn.
You know what? Instagram is a great example of this. You know, there are a couple coaches, you know, every once in a while I'm just scrolling because Instagram really gives me, I'm not a slave to Instagram, but it really gives me these windows into what are people working on? How are they thinking? How are we talking? What are we missing on? Like, it's really, I get to drop into really sophisticated programs and sort of be a voyeur without having travel. It's amazing. That's how I use it.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'm like, ooh, let me click on this person. I'm like, what? 2 million followers? Like, what the? What? You know, like, this is.
You've not taken your shirt off, Kelly. That's what you need.
You laugh, but that's actually one of the differentials that we've been told from our like social media team. Like, you don't have enough skin. You know, so one of the things. And look, maybe this is just self-rationalization, but the way I use social media is a teaching platform, because I start with this idea that, hey, I probably haven't done a good job making myself understood or been clear enough in my thing. And if I just keep giving you, you know, I probably put up 5 to 7 essays a week about what I think, how I'm doing it, the problems I'm solving. And I've been doing this for over 10 years. I have been putting free content in the universe for 10 years. So every week I make this the equivalent of a feature film of content, right? And then I release it. And like, you know, thank you for your patronage, for your comments on my free content. But what you'll see is I'm not trying to capture your attention. Dude, you have to slow down and watch me speak for 8 to 10 minutes about a complicated subject. And I can't reduce that to a single minute with lots of sexy butts, you know, and or grab the thing. And the algorithm doesn't serve me. And that's not why I'm using it. I'm usurping the algorithm to help the coaches and to serve my community better. And I know that if I do a better job of communicating, better production, better synthesis of ideas, the people who are looking for it will find it, and not capturing, you know, being the shiny new object. And this is why we've been doing this for 10 years and we continue to grow and we continue to help people. And I get to continue to be involved because that's our intention from day one. As you said, let's not go out to be the famous. Ugh, I don't want to be famous. What a horrible, horrible nightmare that is. We have athletes for that. Instead, I get to go behind the scenes and do all the fun stuff and work with all my heroes, and all my heroes turn out to be coaches.
Well, you've probably experienced a little bit of fame if you can remember back to when we used to be able to go to in-person conferences, because you'd be walking along through the expo towards the lecterns and deliver your presentation, and or you probably said to your wife, "I'll go get a couple of coffees," and 3 hours later you turn up with 2 cold coffees because every man and his dog wants. There's Kelly Starrett. Let's get hold of him, Kelly, and you know, that's on a similar scale. That happens to me when I go to a triathlon conference, and actually it becomes a little tiresome after a while. I definitely wouldn't like to be David Beckham or you know, Patrick Mahomes or any of those guys. Well, you just can't go anywhere and get anything done.
Fortunately, I'm not as handsome as David Beckham, fortunately for me, right? And for my wife, frankly. But you know, I think it is, you know, the notoriety that this speaks to, you know, to bring it back into this coaching idea, is that, you know, people want the greatest hits. They want, you know, the quick result, the quick gains. And that's, again, let's recognize that as a feature, not a bug. That, like, you know, it's difficult to make the case for less carbohydrate, less sugar. It's because it's tasty and my brain is wired for it. And that kid over there just won the race. And I'm like, well, that kid over there has 2 Olympians as parents and has been her training age. She started running and lifting when she was 6, you know, and you're not her. So, you know, it's difficult for us to appreciate that because I think that's what drives us a little bit, but simultaneously we have to temper that with this real long-term development and appreciating that. You know, I think as long as we have fetishized sports so much and really, you know, looked at our professional athletes as like our heroes, and that's what I show my children aspire to, I have to tell you that we will end up corrupting collegiate sports. We'll end up corrupting, and that's the right word, corrupting high school sports. We'll corrupt middle school sports. And then we forget that sport is a transformation. Sport is a laboratory where we can understand best practice and best process, where we can create durable, we can create mental frameworks and actually apply that to the things that really matter, which is the rest of our lives and society. And so really, that's why I'm such a fan of sport. And I really have a complicated relationship with high-level sports sometimes. I'm like, well, they're like gladiators and they're broken and we throw their, you know, their diseased carcasses on the pile. And then there's some young phenom coming through. And yet simultaneously, you know, sport unites people and it unites communities and gives us something to strive for and reminds us what's possible and that we're physical beings and lights the fire. But we just, the documentarian who did the Civil War, Ken Burns, all these other movies, he has a sign in his office that says it's complicated. And so I want us all to stop saying it depends. Instead, I want us to say it's complicated, and that's okay. Complexity. We should always be striving to understand complex systems because we are the most complex system in the known universe. So it's okay that it takes us a second to find our feet and be nuanced and to get people on the right track and looking at their sleep. And, you know, and what we really understand then is man, these core practices, this is how we become durable. This is how we prove longevity. And yet it's not the sexy quick win in the beginning, right? Because when you're 17, you can do whatever you want.
Of course, talking about complicated, we'll then have to go down the whole debate about complex doesn't mean complicated or vice versa.
That's right. That's right. We are right. It's simplicity. Simplexity is what we call it, right? Right. It's informed simplicity. What are the non-essential or the non-negotiables? And that's really, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but you do a lot of teaching for things that every 10-year-old should know. Right? How to cook breakfast, how to fuel for a sport, right? How to put themselves to bed. And I'm like, why am I telling you this? You're an adult, you know, and it's because we failed people is why.
Let's talk about this book. This was your first one, Supple Leopard. Was this really just an extension of everything you'd done on the mobility what then?
And yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a chance for us to, you know, to really... You know, the problem with the internet is it's one of those pictures of 10, it's pixelated 10,000 pictures. And until you get back, you're like, oh, it's a picture of Nelson Mandela or, you know, it's a sailboat. And what we needed to do was, you know, I had been teaching a course for a spell and I had the big building blocks, but this was a chance to put down sort of what I believed and how to see the relationship between movement and these positional restoration exercises. Because I don't, you know, people are like, well, what about movement? All you do is stretch. I'm like, did you see that the first half of the book is Olympic lifting and kettlebell work and basic gymnastics, right? What I don't do is tell people how to train, but you'll see in those fundamental positions, the first half of the book is principles around movement. And then the second half of the book turns out to be ways that we can restore your position mechanics. And I've gotten even better at explaining it since, I mean, that book is now 7 years old. And, you know, what we're doing a better job of is explaining our thinking of integration into systems and giving people cake recipes, you know, so that you can apply it to your yoga community, your swimming community, your running community, your lifting community, whatever it is. Really, it's universal and it has to be universal.
So... somebody asked me actually, and I had to go and read up on it in the introduction to the book about how did you come across the title? And of course, you reference some scene from Gallipoli where a guy says he's going to run like a leopard, and what's a leopard like now fast? And then somebody else said to you, you know what, Kelly, a leopard never stretches. So I'm sort of extrapolating that out and thinking, so really, as human beings, we ought to do as many diverse movements in as many directions as possible during our day, which means that we would never have to actually do a 20-minute concentrated spell of mobility. Unfortunately, life isn't like that, and it's going further away from that now. But would I be right in inferring that if you did move around like a leopard and perhaps do, you know, as I'm moving through my house now, instead of walking, I should do some animal flow movements and do a crab walk or a bear walk or a side traveling ape to get out of the door, which enables me to move in a different way.
Well, let's think of this slightly differently. So the first idea is, well, I'm like, why do you feel like you don't have your range of motion? Like, these are native ranges that every physician studies, every physio studies, every chiro studies, every naturopath studies. It's what everyone agrees the human shoulder should be able to do. How the ankle should move this much, right? And then all of a sudden, you come in with a complex movement problem. And I'm like, wow, I noticed that every time you eat, your elbow gets stuck at 90 degrees. That's so strange. Does that ever create a problem for you? Yeah, my wrist hurts all the time, and so does my neck. I'm like, well, it's not your wrist or your neck. It's your elbow stuck at 90 degrees. And people are like, well, that's dumb. I would know. And I'm like, well, that's what's going on with your quads and your knee. So you're trying to run out the door, and your legs are stuck. You're missing 50% of your range of motion in one of your key limbs. Let's go down and talk about your ankle. Oh, it's 70% of your ankle range of motion. And yet your body is so durable and so remarkable that you're still able to do really well. So our first idea was like, well, hey, how come you just don't have access to your physical power, your ranges, your positions? And that doesn't need to change when you're old. And it's weird that the Russians say you're as old as your feet. The Chinese say you're as old as your spine, right? That, you know, when you stop jumping, you start dying. I mean, there are all these old maxims in there around making sure. And suddenly if you go into, for example, like yoga, which is a movement practice, not a stretching practice. If you went into yoga, you could look at yoga as basically long lever, which is straight limb control with a lot of isometrics and breathing. That's what we think of it. It's tempo work. It's slow work. We get to work on strange positions and mechanics and pauses, just like we do isometrics in the gym. But if you go in there with those eyes, you're like, holy crap, there's some real powerful thinking in yoga. And then you jump into Pilates and you're like, holy crap, Joseph Pilates was not messing about. He had some ideas around what the spine should be able to do, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go into kettlebells and you're like, holy crap, someone figured this out in Russia a long time ago about what the shoulder needs to do. And suddenly what you begin to see again is that there are fundamental positions and shapes we all agree on that make the root language. Now, if I just take you out of this sport activity language and then look at your day-to-day movement lexicon, your vernacular, your vocabulary, well, it turns out you use three words, you know, sit, stand, walk a little bit, sit, stand, walk a little bit. That's all you do. And so suddenly I'm like, well, if you are capable of writing Shakespearean sonnets with your body, but you use three words without punctuation, maybe there's a distinction. So now the conversation is, okay, well, in the context of a busy human being and an athlete who doesn't need to train every range and every corner, the brain is complicated. You don't need to do prehab so you can go swim. That's ridiculous. You need to get hot and sweaty and work on mechanic and swim drills and then go swim. The idea here is, well, what if you just sat on the ground a little bit? What if you walked around a little bit more during the day? What if you had to get up and down off the ground a whole bunch? What if, you know, you jumped into a movement practice to, and remember, it probably doesn't matter if you're not an athlete, you can get away with a lot. You know, one of my favorite coaches right now is a guy from the Netherlands named Frans Bosch. And he's written a book called The Anatomy of Agility, which I think is wonderful. And his first book is incredible. But there's a Frans Bosch quote that everyone, if you're a deep nerd, definitely read Frans Bosch. But he says there's more variation in waltzing than there is in sprinting, which means at low level, low speed, low intensity, low load, the body can handle a lot of loading, a lot of weird movement. But as we start to go faster, as we start to need to have access to our positions and mechanics, the best expressions of physiology really look the same. We might have a different language to coach it, but the top swimmers all look very much the same to the untrained eye. What you see is signatures in body length, how long my humerus is, what my cadence is for my flutter. Those are the real differences, but the technique is the technique. You don't coach 50 different swim strokes. You have an idea of what you think is the best way to move forward in the water, and then you spend your whole life trying to get people to feel that and be able to maintain that when they're fatigued and they're competing. So really what we're trying to say here is, you know, if this is the core of what we're trying to do, you know, and we start to see these sort of basic premises of these positions, then how can we shift our environment a little bit more so that we have to do less restorative position mechanics? And that's why a good strength conditioning program is actually just a movement practice. So when I was lecturing at the Stanford Medical School, I asked all the doctors, I'm like, how many of you are in a movement practice? And someone raises their hand up and they're like, I'm a runner. And I was like, that's a sport, not a movement practice. And they were like, what? And someone's like, swimmer. And I was like, sport, not a movement practice. And then some meeky person in the front's like, I do yoga. I was like, movement practice, congratulations. Like, you nailed it. And then someone else is like, I do Pilates. And I was like, you got it. And someone's like, CrossFit. I'm like, you got it. And all we're doing there is in those movement practices is you're just exposing the tissues, just exposure. Just look at it as exposure. Forget reps, forget sets. Do you ever just put your arms over your head, yes or no? Maybe that would help you be a better swimmer if you did that during the day.
Going right back to your starting sport when you were kayaking, and I read somewhere, maybe it was an article that you'd written or been interviewed for, where you talked about generalization versus specialization, particularly in the Eastern European sport programs. There was only really two sports, wasn't there? Gymnastics and swimming, I think, which were early specialization sports and mostly for females. Everything else had a general practice first, and then athletes specialized at a later date. And I do wonder now, because a lot of the people I see that do triathlon, they think that they've got a varied program because they swim, bike and run, but it's really just in the sagittal plane. There's very little rotation apart from, you know, as they're swimming, and sometimes that's limited. There's a little bit of upper body rotation in counterbalancing the running technique, but sometimes that's limited. And there might be a little bit of rotation in cycling when you have to look over your shoulder. Other than that, there isn't really a great deal of, it's quite a specialized sport. And if you're a single sport athlete, then it's even more limited. But I do see that some of the world's best athletes in endurance sports have a grounding in a general conditioning. You know, they play team sports. So I don't know if you're familiar with triathletes, but Merinda Carfrae was a basketball player. Craig Alexander was a soccer player. You know, those guys are two of the best triathlon runners I've seen.
Building general athletic capacities somehow makes us more durable and more skilled? Well, you know, it is an arms race, and everyone can appreciate this, because if you have children, you know, you get sucked into, my kids, and they're going to fall behind if they do more than sports. If they don't play football year round, they don't go to the special football training and then do all these special things. What we see is just general lack of durability and skill. Your kids aren't very skilled, and they can do one thing very well, but just it exposes them to fragility. It exposes them to less tissue tolerance. They can't work as hard. So the question is, you know, early on is like what I say is GPP, general physical preparedness. That's what every mom and dad should do. Your kettlebell swinging, your push-upping, your pull-ups, the movements of classic strength and conditioning, which really allow us to train the body effectively through bigger ranges of motion. Well, then we end up to what I call general preparation, general sports prep, right? Which is we start to pay attention to the details a little more. Foot positioning, foot balance. It's not just physiology. It's not just do more air squats and you'll look good on Instagram. It really matters why we're training in those things. And the idea is to create a body that's ready and to restore the body's position in the off season so that we can then go into the sport where we really do sport-specific training. And when I mean sport-specific training, it's not like you're not a swimmer. You don't do special swimmer exercises. What I mean is, the goal of strength training in season is to make you a better athlete. And that not to make you stronger at some gym activities. It's about keeping you swimming, keeping your sport, keeping you running. And the only way I can measure the effectiveness of my sessions is if you get better at your sport and can do more of your sport. So if I take you to the gym and trash you for 2 hours and you can't go run, I'm a terrible coach, right? Don't get me wrong. Sometimes we have to start with people and I'm like, you're going to be sore because we're doing some things you've never done before and that my 12-year-old can do, but we'll monitor your volume. So that's really what we need to be thinking about a little bit in terms of our training. But again, you know, how strong you need to be to swim? Well, strong enough to be able to maintain your positions over the course of a swim. Not any stronger. That means we can work on other things. And it is, you know, the gym really took a central role in people's imagination for the last 10 years because we became a little bit more sophisticated. We suddenly had more tools. We got out of these selectorized equipment things. And it was easy to see progress in the gym. It's hard to see refinements in your running technique. It's easy to see that you put another plate on the bar, right? And what we forgot is it's all about transference. It's all about just exposure. And really the goal is what's the minimum strength positional training I can do to support your sport? And that is the only thing we think about.
So this was a bit, I'm not going to go off on this one now, but this was a debate I had on one of my Facebook groups the other day with a strength coach who came with a very heavily biased, heavily focused strength approach versus triathlon coaches, and just reminded me that he was too focused on getting strong. You know, he said, you know, everybody should be able to squat twice the body weight, back squat twice the body weight. But how does that transfer to running faster? You know, does it transfer to running faster? If you can do 10 pull-ups, is that really relevant? The best swimmers probably can do 10 pull-ups, but are they the best swimmers because they can do 10 pull-ups or because they're the best athletes? And
so important. And yet what we see is that people are having this conversation and can't do a pull-up or can't do 3 pull-ups.
Yeah.
So I'm like, wow, you really, and can't do a good pull-up, right? And, or we're not even using the pull-up as a position transfer exercise to teach rotation, to teach stability, to teach organizing the shoulder, to teach right control through the trunk. Watch someone do a pull-up, and I guarantee you that's what their legs and low back will do when they fatigue in the water, right? Like, I'm like, you can't point your toes and squeeze your butt and do a pull-up. How are you going to pull through the water when you butterfly or have to kick? So I'm like, what's really nice is suddenly we can expose, but you're right. How many pull-ups is enough pull-ups? How do we train that? How do we just have this consistent coordination exposure, practice skill exposure? And at some point I'm like, you can do enough pull-ups, but if you can't do a pull-up, this is going to be tricky.
As recreational athletes, do you think we do enough mobility? Bearing in mind what we all talked about, do you think we could do more? And forgive me if I'm wrong here. And I know in your book you talk about, can everybody find 15 minutes to do 15 minutes of mobility during the day? But I've got in my mind that there's this ratio of 15 minutes to every 60 minutes of.
Nah. I think maybe those were fun just so stories, right? Like, here's the first of all is one or zero. Are you doing anything petition? And what we found was that if we put 10 minutes of soft tissue work at the end of the night, and had you conjoin it with your movement practice. So, hey, what was stiff today? Oh, my hips felt a little stiff. Great. Why don't you work on your hips for 10 minutes? So what we saw was then people started making the connections between their activity versus, you know, the reason we don't stretch is like all you did was stretch, and it had no goals and it didn't make you faster. But suddenly what we realized is like you can sleep better, we can work on your positional quality, you can restore your stiffness, we can enhance your adaptation, that reduce your session cost. And so really the goal for us is, hey, let's develop a practice of downregulation. Let's practice, like, does any athlete on the planet say, yeah, there's no benefits in massage? You know, I mean, like people are like, no, I love massage. I'm like, great. Well, let's just massage your body, yourself for 10 minutes. Like, what are we talking about? And what we realize is that you don't have to make this a full-time sport. What I want you to do is, again, be able to have this diagnostic lens, which is say, can I achieve this position? Yes or no. And let me just work on it. And I'll get the rest of it tomorrow. And I'll continue to work in the context of everything else. So I don't have to stop training or stop walking or stop running. What I need to do is just say, hey, where are the places in my day where I can spend a little time on this? And suddenly that aggregates into a massive amounts of change.
So if you, we've talked about Eastern European practices, because that's where a lot of strength stuff and myths have
lots of myths.
From. Because, you know, the whole periodization thing is great if you've got one event and, you know, sequential type stuff and all of that.
Yeah, your kid never gets sick.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Tudor Bomper is obviously one of the forefathers of all of that. And in one of his books, he talks about the five steps, you know, improve mobility, improve stability, improve the core, improve the prime movers, then work on movements, not muscles. Which would lead you to think, if you were uneducated, that perhaps you had to do those things consecutively and you shouldn't start lifting until you got your mobility and you shouldn't start doing any of this until you'd improve your joint stability. Particularly if you use something like kettlebells, which allows your body to move through various different motions and in multiple directions. Is it possible for athletes to build mobility at the same time as the building strength, or do we really need to focus on a little bit of mobility first? Because if we haven't got the mobility through a shoulder, doing a kettlebell snatch, you're probably going to end up badly.
Well, you'll end up either not completing it or compensating to get it done the same way you'll compensate in the water. So let's apply your same level of rigor of swinging a kettlebell to you doing your sport. Right. So you're like, I can't do an air squat. I'm like, well, how are you going to get into the time trial position? Oh, you're not. You're just going to round your back over and end up like an angry cat and impinge your hip. And
yeah.
So, you know, people are like, oh, this is so dangerous. I'm like, have you seen yourself swim lately? I mean, let's talk about dangerous. And like, you know, I'm talking about doing, you know, like five sets of 10 reps. And you're talking about taking a million swim strokes in a session as you swim, yep. You know, your 10K every morning. So, you know, the key here is the first order of business to building tissue tolerance and restoring position is to actually spend time in that position. That's the first order of business. So no matter what, no matter where you are, what injury position, however your mechanics are, we're going to squat today because that's such a foundational position to restore your mechanics, make your hips connect to your femur, et cetera, et cetera. But you may not squat ass to grass. We may not load it. We may not have an upright torso, but we're going to squat, right? You may be injured, but we're still going to squat. And we may be tempo box squats, 6 inches. But what we're not going to let you do is achieve some arbitrary range of motion that says you're successful or unsuccessful. What we're going to do is have you be able to move your body with control through a range of motion where you still have control and stop compensating. Because if I turn your feet out to jump and land or to swing a kettlebell or to squat and you collapse your arches and your knees come in, what position do you think that's going to reinforce on the bike? Practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent, mm-hmm. Right? And what I want you to see is that, man, I'm pretty sure I run and cycle with my feet going straight if I want to be the world's best athlete. So why are you practicing all of your strength movements with your feet turned out? Well, because it's easier. Well, okay. Well, why is that easy? Why don't you have, you know, you wonder why your knee hurts on the bike. You know, I work with Specialized. I'm on their Retool bike fitting team. Right. And part of the company, I spend a lot of time with Specialized. We're trying to do more at home bike fitting. But what we've been doing forever is fitting the machine to the person. Meanwhile, we ask nothing of the person. We just keep making the machine fit a more and more dysfunctional person, right? And I'm like, you don't have enough tolerance in your body that a millimeter of difference on your stem height you think is the difference between winning and losing? That's curious.
I'll give you an interesting story there. So I talk about Louisa the White Witch, and she does a bike fit where she does a full biomechanical assessment, probably not too dissimilar to the sort of movement screening you do. Mm. And she looks at the capabilities and movement skills and limitations of the athlete first, and then she does the bike fit. You should see the faces on the athletes who turn up with a 4,000 pound Cervelo that's been fitted by a guy who's a bike fitter, not a triathlon fitter, a bike fitter, and he's got them in the wind tunnel, and their elbows are so close that they can hardly breathe. They might as well be wearing a shake jacket. They can only look about 3 feet in front of them because the seat position and the front cockpit position are so out of sync. You can see the hips moving left to right because the saddle's too high, or they haven't got the hamstring range. And then she sort of says, right, well, we need to put a few spaces up here. What? The saddle, the handlebars need to be higher. Yeah, and we need to drop the saddle. But it doesn't look right if it's lower, you know. And we maybe need you on shorter cranks. So now hold on a minute. But this bike is great on Instagram as it is, and now you're going to change it, and it doesn't look very good. But because they've basically taken the person and then they fitted them to the machine and then tried to bend them in position. And then, of course, people leave the wind tunnel having been told they've got the most aerodynamic position, and they never do any prep work to enable them to stay in that position for longer. And then they wonder why, after 5 minutes into their Ironman or whatever, they're sitting on the hoods, and that expensive front end setup's no better than the clothes dryer. Yeah, I'm frustrated at the number of times I've seen that scenario enacted out.
Well, that is exactly what you and I are talking about today, is you don't have the movement language or vocabulary to achieve the most effective positions. But what we've been saying is some in strength and conditioning or maybe swim, bike, run, right? Yet, as soon as we're on some kind of neutral ground bike, you're like, we threw it out. This is exactly what I'm talking about. I want to give you the language back so that you can make the best choices on your body, that you can choose the best setup for you based on the length of your torso and the length of your femurs and the length of what feels where you generate the most wattage. We did some testing, but it's because you have choice. It's not, this is the only position I can be in, so therefore it must be the best position, right? Like, I'm like, dude, you know, if you have to eat with a really long fork, I appreciate that you have solved this problem because you have this really long fork to get the food to your face, but you still can't bend your elbow. Wouldn't it be nice to eat something with your hands? And, you know, that's really seems extreme, but it's exactly what you and I are talking about today. And then the question is, well, can I just, you know, do more exercise? I'm like, well, it hasn't worked so far, has it? You know what I mean? And it seems like there's a lot of physios out there and a lot of chiros and a lot of naturopaths and a lot of white witches and body workers who push on your body, and then suddenly you can do something, right? And again, the mechanisms may be complex. We may be upregulating your isometric control or reconnecting something to your brain or releasing stiffness or addressing a capsular restriction or getting a tissue to slide. I don't care what the mechanism is. The proof in the pudding is biomotor output. And the only thing I care about is, did you go faster to the limits of your ability or not? Yes or no?
Per your comment earlier about Instagram and Instagram hits for coaches, Strava, you know.
Strava is good for the business.
More volume equals better hits on Strava, more likes. I'd like to get more sleep, said nobody ever, in a bid to improve their athletic performance. And yet, if they had that spare hour in the day, I'm sure you and I and the White Witch and all of the other people in our domain would probably say, you know, rather than going for an extra hour's running, just spend an hour in bed or spend 15 minutes mobilizing and 45 minutes in bed.
Go for a walk, jump in the sauna. You know, I did a podcast with Trainer Road at Strava headquarters.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to throw Strava under the bus right now because Strava is amazing. It allows us to connect and find great rides and yada, yada. Comma, I've never seen a more injured office in my whole life, going for personal best streaks, right? Because, again, if that is how we constrain the system, that will be the outcome. And I just want people to appreciate that, you know? We were like, oh, junk volume. Let's get rid of the junk volume. Like, who says you can't go run a jog a 5K breathing nose only? It's just a recovery. Like, no one's ever saying you can't move, right? Or don't be active every single day. But I think you can't go to the well day after day after day and not look at your position, sleep, and mechanics, nutrition. And guess what? You're going to make some mistakes, and welcome to the infinite game of trying to do the best you can do with your body in the context of your life. And that is what is so magnificent about this whole approach, is that you're not a robot. If it was just racing our physiology, we would just put you on a spin bike and we would all do Wahoo, you know, interval contests, right? We'd just be on Zwift and whoever had the biggest, you know, but that's not racing. You know, that's not what it's about. You know, Levi Leipheimer is a really good friend of mine, and man, that guy can race a bike. He knows how to compete. He knows how to prepare himself. He knows how to battle and come back. And, you know, sport is the thing that makes the invisible visible. And one of the reasons I want everyone that I work with to do, even if they're just a recreational athlete, to sign up for a race, to sign up for an event, to sign up for an adventure, is it forces you to look at all your environmental loads. It forces you to look at your behaviors. And then you start to say, okay, I've been kind of lying about how much sleep I've been getting. I've been lying about how much soft tissue work I've been doing, or lying about how much wine I've been drinking. Because suddenly when there's more stress on the system, there's less tolerance in the system. Again, there's more variation in waltzing than there is in sprinting. There's more variation in your lifestyle when you're just walking around cruising than there is when you're preparing for a race.
You like using the mobility balls and the foam rollers, but whenever I use those, they feel sort of sore, almost painful. So, but you talked earlier about trying to avoid pain.
It's because you're a hot mess. That's why. So look, the key is that you push on some normal tissues. Let's start some benchmarks. Normal tissues are painless to compression. So if I push on something and it hurts, I found stiffness in the tissue, and my body is perceiving that stiffness as pain. It's a pain signal. Hmm. So part of what we're trying to do is restore how efficient, how elegantly your body can move. What's the economy of your motion? And it turns out if you have knee pain and I go upstream on your quadriceps and push on your quads in any device and it hurts, those things are strangely connected.
You've been looking at my my pathology every year, because that is where I'm at now. I've had three surgeries for torn cartilage, and at the moment my left knee is a bit sore. And when I get in and do my quads and my hip flexor, and you know, vastus lateralis on my left is tighter. I'm working on it every day, and it's getting better. It's a 57 year old body as well.
That's right. That's right. And what I want people to appreciate is that we all have slightly different shapes and geometry. The word is anthropometry, right? Like your femur length and width of our pelvis, and those are all slightly different. And so we'll solve a movement solution. We might run exactly the same. We run at 94 cadence. We look the same, but the musculature and soft tissues to achieve that end up being slightly different loaded. So you'll have your own unique pattern of loading, plus your unique injury, plus your unique signatures of other movement. So what you end up doing is end up ultimately building a sort of movement restoration language that helps you to manage what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, what you'll start to see, and then, you know, if you have some tissue trauma, what you'll begin to see is that your body is really good at compensating for that. So again, now it's nice. Well, hey, I'm, you know, my knee hurts. Oh, let me just, I realize that I'm a little stiff in the quads, or I'm missing hip extension. Let me just do the minimum to maintain that. And then I get my range of motion back and my power goes back up, and whoop, you know, Bob's your uncle.
Let's talk about your next book, Kelly. I'm interested in that Ready to Run book that you wrote. That came out after Born to Run. Was that any kickback to Born to Run and the sort of the repercussions that there were for the running industry as a result of telling everybody they could run barefoot?
So one of the reasons we call this thing Ready to Run is that Chris McDougall is a good friend of mine. So the writer of Born to Run is a good friend, and it's total homage to the fact that I believe that running is one of those fundamental human skills that we can all do and we should all be able to do. In fact, I would say the health of the organism, it's a nice test for me. What do you mean you can't run? You can't run 400 meters barefoot? I'm like, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying that's the best way to run barefoot all the time, but if you can't run effectively and absorb force, et cetera, then I'm like, hey, there's some part of your DNA that's not being able to express itself. But what we saw was, I saw and worked with a lot of injured runners, and runners who didn't have some basic range of motion, didn't know how to prep or prepare or sort of manage some of those things. And what we were seeing was some of those basic adaptation errors. Oh, I got to get in a run. So I'm already dressed in my kit and now I'm just going to hit the go. I'll just go easy for a couple minutes and then run and then come back to the office and sit down. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. If we did that with a horse, the horse would get pneumonia and die. You know what I mean? But you're so taunt, you can manage that. So what we tried to do with that book is really just say, this is the simplest non- like triggering third rail. Like I didn't talk about pose or pulling or running or what style. I just was like, hey, here's some things I think that can really improve your durability as a runner. And we tried to do that. And so Ready to Run really was because, you know, I was played American football, but had terrible knee pain when I ran and I could do everything, but terrible knee pain when I ran. And I learned how to run as an adult where I stopped heel striking and I started running like a human being runs. And guess what? I ran an ultra marathon. And guess what? You know, I run effortlessly and I love to run and running is a joy, but it turns out I didn't know how to run. And that's those things that we're just like, just do more volume, more volume. So really, I was reading Born to Run and there was this description of running that snapped in my head and I put the book down and I went outside and I understood running for the first time.
It's interesting to me when people talk about, you know, I'm not sure if I'm born to be a runner. And yet, if you watch little kids whose minds haven't been polluted about how you're supposed to run, and you watch them, you know, sprint along the beach or sprint along the grass without shoes on, they just run naturally. They've got high cadence, the heels come up, they land on the right position of the foot. And then as they get older and they get stiffer and they sit down more and they don't do as much multi-direction movement, their technique changes. And then when they become adults and they start running, they've got no elasticity in the heel. They've got no elasticity in the hamstring. They've got no support in the glutes and everything's just become a shuffle.
Check this out. Children are so weak. They don't strength train, but they can sprint, right? They can run around. They have to keep the cadence high to load the fascia.
Yeah.
If they don't keep the cadence high, they're not springy and they're actually not strong enough. So what you see is that the system doesn't work unless they keep the cadence high. Kipchoge ran what? Sub 2 hours, nose breathing at a cadence of what? 94, 95, 96?
Yeah.
Curious.
It's interesting, actually. There's a coach, a run coach in the UK called Shane Benzie. I'm not sure if you've come across him.
I don't think so.
He does a lot of stuff about, he talks about fascia quite a lot. And there's a mixed camp about whether that's just, you know, hocus pocus or whether there's actually some substance to it. I think there's probably more to it. I'm trying to get Shane on a call, but maybe I should get the two of you together.
Well, if you get us together, you're going to hear me point and say, yes, I think fascia and springiness is important. And we've lost our springiness. And I'll tell you what, the cycling, it's really interesting. In CrossFit, for example, we do a lot of very low cadence things, and some of the assault bike work and some of the metabolic work and running work is very low cadence. And people lose their springiness. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I'm like, go run. And they go run at 80 or 85, 86, yeah. 87. And I'm like, wow, you're just plodding at that point. We actually, one of our friends, Brian McKenzie, calls it not running. You're doing a running like motion, but unless you're 90, you're not running. Right.
That's Brian McKenzie of CrossFit Endurance, right?
Used to be CrossFit Endurance. Now it's Shift. That's right. But Brian is a really important thinker and around my thinking about sort of running and running mechanics and some of all that. And, the key, what I'd say though is, you know, around the fascia piece is if you take fascia out of the system doesn't work. It's like, you know, you have to have heat, oxygen, and fuel. Well, if you don't have any oxygen, you can't have a fire. If you take fascia out, the whole human being falls apart.
Okay, so Chris McDougall, his next book, Natural Born Heroes,
which is about
the guys in Crete and the Cretians, a large portion of that is about fascia and the importance of the fascia in running. So was that your influence there?
No, what you'll see is that Chris got there on his own from Erwan LaCour and people like that and all some of our work. And if you read the new introduction, the reprint, he talks about Supple Leopard in there. And the only reason I mention that is what Chris's brilliance was saying, hey, there are some fundamental truths to some of these things, eating a certain way, maintaining load and springy and range of motion and how does that look different than me sitting down on a machine doing leg extensions? Like that's not very coordinate. It's not very springy. It doesn't teach those things. Mm. And so, you know, what you'll see is go to a playground. And if you just look, we have modern ways to train. I'm not just romanticizing playground children stuff. But if you just hung out with some first graders and just played on the playground for an hour, you'd be smoked. And I guarantee you would go run better, right? Because you'd have to be springy, you'd have to be quick, you'd have to change direction. But a lot of that stuff, again, I think we've lost our minds around, like we should be able to get that to play a little bit, you know, like some little, like Bella Carolla used to let his male gymnasts warm up with indoor soccer. You know, I think that's really interesting because I don't think we need to formalize every rotation plane with a medicine ball in the gym. But man, what happened if we went and played a little frisbee or a little pickup footy? You know, all of a sudden, like, dude, you can play indoor soccer and not die. You don't have to, you know, but all of that alone would go a long ways. And for me, the expression of that was, why don't you jump rope a little bit, you know?
I used to be the strength and conditioning coach for Yorkshire Cricket. So cricket's like baseball on Valium, right? And the players around that time used to like to warm up. Quite a lot of them were very avid football fans and footballers, and they used to like to warm up by playing football. And England were still using this practice until a few years ago, maybe before an Ashes match, and one of the players pulled a hamstring. And all that was in the press was the ridiculousness of letting the players warm up by playing football when they should have been playing cricket. And I'm like, you're missing the point. You've focused on one little bit, and there'll be another reason why that guy pulled his hamstring. It's not the football.
It's not the football. The football was the reason they were successful.
Yeah.
Right? Because they got to connect and communicate and play and have little contact and expose themselves laterally, and they were ready to play. And it was also part of the ritual. And so, you know, it is easy. And I think especially sometimes when people who come to triathlon full exposure, my two sports are long distance endurance paddle racing and mountain biking. So I'm into this camp of endurance athletics. Adventurous fitness is what I call it now. But, you know, it's easy to get on a spreadsheet and be living by heart rate and power and time splits. And once again, there's not a lot of joy. There's satisfaction there, but there's not a lot of play in there. And we've definitely potentially sucked a lot of the play and camaraderie and competition. And, you know, I want my kids to compete in the pool every day. You know what I mean? Like there's not a reason why we can't put a surprise, you know, 50 meter match right in the middle of the race and play around or do combination strokes. And, you know, both my daughters play water polo. So we do a lot of swimming in our family. You know, they also both Olympic lift, you know, and they both ride mountain bikes. And so the conversations I'm having with you, I'm living because both my daughters are swimmers. They both play water polo. They both ride on the mountain bike team and they both Olympic lift. So really, how do I keep an eye on this athletic development? They both also ski. They like to play. My daughter rides her bike to school. Like, how do we create this movement richness? Because I don't know if they're going to be good athletes. I don't really care. What I care is, like, this is, you know, non-negotiable for us. So, you know, really, you know, when you should never dread practice. You should dread practice because it's going to be hard, right? You're going to have to show up and do it. But practice is the one place where you can make mistakes, where you can be with other people, where you get to put your, like, it, we just have sucked out all the joy out of it, you know, and I just think we can do better.
So let me see if I can sum up Kelly in a few words, which will be difficult because we've covered a lot, but I think the general principle is this, particularly if you're an endurance sport that tends to move in one direction, is move more.
That's right.
Play more, get the basics right, and find some joy in everything you do.
And rinse, wash, repeat. And, you know, take a look at your nutrition, take a look at your blood, take a look at your sleep. All the things that you preach are the ways that we untangle chronic pain, persistent pain and injury. It's also the same conversations we have about our elite athletes going the fastest and setting world records. And I just want people to understand it's the same continuum. And, you know, I think the lastly is just that, you know, you can be a very, very capable athlete for much longer than you realize. But if you play a short game, you'll have a short outcome.
Yeah. And let's remember, it might be complex, but it doesn't need to be complicated.
No, right. It's gotten so simple in my brain now that people are like, it can't be that simple. I'm like, I think it's this simple.
Yeah. Well, you have to have the confidence and the experience to know that simple is probably best, don't you?
Oh, and it's hardest. It's harder. It's so hard. You know, I'm like, oh, you really don't feel like you got enough volume? Well, today we're doing 5K time trials. So we're going to repeat those until your wattage falls off. And people were like, this is plenty of volume. I'm like, yeah, there you go.
Kelly, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I'm pretty certain that everybody that's listening will want to find out more about you and where they can follow you. So can you give us some of the the main places you hang out?
It's really simple. We are everywhere on social media at The Ready State. And our site is at thereadystate.com, The Ready State. And one of the things I want everyone to know is if you really wanted to initiate a conversation about taking some self-care, we have a 2-week free membership where we have an on-ramp program and we'll teach you the basics of self-care. So you can manage some of these things and run through that a little bit. March 1st, we are launching our new app, which has an incredible movement assessment built in so you can get more connected. So it's just sort of keeping an eye on your sort of movement vital signs. That's out March 1st, and I'm super thrilled about that because we've been working on that for a long time, and it's really good. But the bottom line is, you can push anywhere to begin. You can initiate this conversation anywhere. And what you're realizing is that you're much more sophisticated than you realize, and you actually have all the tools to actually make yourself feel better and run better. And that really is what it comes down to. We can simplify the system.
Dr. Kelly Starrett, it's been brilliant. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Such a pleasure. I can't wait to meet you in London, go to Borough Market, get a cup of Monmouth and have a sausage roll. I mean, I'm living to get back to the UK.
I'm living for you to be here, mate. When you come, I'm down there.
Book it.
Thanks for being on the show.
Pleasure.
All right, well, that's it for this week. Thank you to Kelly for joining me on the High Performance Human podcast. You can find links to just about everything we chatted about in today's episode in our show notes. Also, a reminder that if you are interested in being part of my SWOT Inner Circle, you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please email beth@thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in those show notes. So as usual, we'll be back next week with another great guest. But for now, stay healthy, stay focused, and concentrate on being a high-performance human in every aspect of your life.